Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Sanjay Taylor presiding, case number 23-0571, People versus Javaris McKnight.
Good afternoon. My name is Sanjay Taylor. I'm a presiding judge of the Sixth Division of the First District Appellate Court. I'm joined this afternoon on the panel by Justice Michael Hyman and Justice Celia Gamrath. If I can ask the counsel to introduce themselves, and we'll start with the defendant's counsel.
Good afternoon. My name is Talon Nouri with the Office of the State Appellate Defender representing Mr. Javaris
Okay, good afternoon, Mr. Marie.
I'm Assistant State's Attorney Erin Slattery on behalf of the people.
Good afternoon, Ms. Slattery. Mr. Nouri, you have 20 minutes to present your argument. How much of that 20 minutes would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, please.
Okay. And Ms. Slattery, you'll have 20 minutes as well. With that, Mr. Nouri.
Good afternoon. As I said, my name is Talon Nouri on behalf of the State Appellate Defender representing Mr. Javaris McKnight. May it please the court. Constructive possession cases, by definition, rely on circumstantial evidence. However, they do require actual evidence. They're not strict liability cases, and a driver of a vehicle is not strictly liable for being in possession of anything found inside a vehicle they just happen to be driving. Just as being a guest in a house does not create liability for anything subsequently found inside that house, likewise, being a driver of a vehicle does not create criminal liability without further proof that the driver knew of the vehicle's contents. The facts of this case are as follows. Police officers in an
Well, we
unlawful.
know the facts. We've read the briefs and the record. One question I have is there was a stipulation with regard that McKnight is a felon.
Yes,
What's
sir.
the nature of that charge? I think he served 10-year prison sentence.
The underlying offense, I believe, was aggravated battery.
And anything else?
Aggravated battery, I discharge of a firearm, yes.
Yes. Okay. And he received a sentence of 10 years, my understanding.
Yes.
Okay. So he was it that that's a it's a very serious charge. And so it was a charge involving a firearm. And in your introduction, one thing you did not mention with regard to circumstantial evidence is that he was stopped by police and then he fled in his car. Now, that can be taken account, can it?
Yes, well, it definitely can be taken into account that he fled from the stop. As I was saying, though, knowledge is an element of the offense of constructive possession. And while fleeing alone might be evidence of consciousness of guilt in some way, without some corroborative proof of knowledge, the probative value of fleeing alone is insufficient to establish knowledge for purposes of constructive possession.
Your argument really is that it's not a reasonable inference that he knew of the presence of the gun.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. It's
Why,
not a
so why
reasonable.
not? Why isn't? I mean, he's a felon, a gun crime, he took off. Why is that not a reasonable inference?
Because in constructive possession cases, as I said, they're not strict liability. There has to be some corroborative proof of knowledge. Otherwise, essentially the state would be asking this court to expand constructive possession jurisprudence to basically create a holding that fleeing alone would be sufficient to convict someone for possessing anything found in a vehicle that they did not own, or in the residential realm, somebody fleeing a residence that was not theirs being held criminally liable for anything that was subsequently found in that residence.
But fleeing from the police on a stop is a very serious situation because, as in this case, there was an accident.
just a few minutes later that he caused. He was he, his vehicle came to a stop because of an accident. And when police stop people, most people obey. And if they flee, as Justice Taylor inquired, I mean, isn't that part of the equation of his having some knowledge that something else was going on in that car?
Well, to the first point, it is serious, and that's why he there was separate charges brought regarding the fleeing. He just happened to be found not guilty for that. Regarding whether what the fleeing itself has to do with establishing knowledge, there the state hasn't cited a case. I haven't been able to find a case where fleeing alone has been sufficient to establish knowledge. And for the purpose for this case specifically, as I was getting into the facts, that is the only element of knowledge that even arguably could establish knowledge in this case. In most cases, when there's flight, there's additional indicia of knowledge. Sometimes knowledge can be established via ownership in the vehicular context. That would be, you know, registration documents or so forth. The state actually, in this case, objected to a question by defense counsel regarding who owned the vehicle. So there was no proof of who owned the vehicle. Without actual ownership, which allows for an indicia of knowledge, sometimes regular and ongoing control. In the residential realm, that's usually like habitation. In the vehicular context, it's regular ongoing control. It can be established via, you know, sometimes personal belongings in the vehicle or other indicia of ownership or use. Sometimes there's been prior traffic offenses. Sometimes there's a statement from the registered owner or the defendant themselves. But in this case, there's none of that. And I would ask this court to look at the cases cited by the state. There is not one where just presence and flight was enough to establish knowledge for
What
purposes
about
of fleeing.
People versus Ingram?
I'm sorry?
389, People versus Ingram, 389 Illap 3rd, 897. Flight from car while ignoring demands to stop, supported inference, defendant possessed gun.
Well, according to the state, that's what happened. But actually, in the case, the gun was in plain view on the floor of the car. So again, that when a contraband is in plain view, that makes the flight at that point, it might be even irrelevant, if not just more corroborative. But here, there was no indication whatsoever that Mr. McKnight was aware of the gun in the glove compartment. It was closed. He made the officer testify to seeing no furtive movement, no physical gestures. Reaching for or trying to attempt to hide the gun. Yet Mr. McKnight
Well, the gun was
afterwards.
already hid. He wouldn't have to do anything. He knew the gun was in the glove compartment. It was not visible.
Well, there's the only proof that he knew the gun was in the glove compartment would be flight. If this court is going to say that flight alone is sufficient to establish knowledge, it would be an expansion of constructive possession jurisprudence. Without some other indicia of knowledge typically associated with these cases. And to be clear, he initially complied with the stop. He was in the process of pulling out his driver's license when officers from both sides attempted to open the doors and demanded that he exit the vehicle. And then, of course, yes, he did flee. But without some other proof of knowledge, the probative value of that flight is rather minimal. There's a number of reasons somebody could flee from a very obvious pretextual stop, as this case that was escalated as quickly as it was.
Did you argue
I mean,
pretextual stop in your brief?
I'm sorry.
Did you argue a pretextual stop?
I mentioned, of course, that it wasn't obviously pretextual stop. Yes, sir.
Mr. Nouri, could the fact that your client initially cooperated and was pulling out his license, I think you mentioned, but then as the police officers opened the door, at that point, he took off. Isn't that some evidence from which one could reasonably infer that he had knowledge of the gun? Because that's why he took off. It was only when the police officers, started intruding upon the vehicle that your client took off.
On the other hand, it could be reasonable to infer that he assumed initially that it was going to be a regular traffic stop. he didn't know why I was being pulled over, but to be immediately demanded that you get out of a vehicle in an unmarked car, there's a number of reasons that somebody might flee from the police in that case. I can't put myself in the shoes of the defendant, of course, but there are people that have had negative interactions with police. I don't think that's a groundbreaking thing to say. And again, there is no, I've been unable to find a case where fleeing alone is sufficient to establish knowledge in these cases. Typically, as Your Honor mentioned, in Ingram, the gun was in plain view. In other cases where flight is used as corroborative evidence of knowledge, there's some other indicia of ownership or regular use, be it prior use, prior traffic violations in the same vehicle, statements from the actual owner saying that the defendant had driven the car before and on regular occasions. So again, it's by itself, as this court has stated in People versus Tates, in that case, the defendant fled when police used a battering ram to break down the front door. This court found that while the flight was probative, standing alone, it didn't satisfy the state's burden to prove that the defendant constructively possessed, in that case, the narcotics that were actually in plain view in the kitchen of that residence. And this court focused on the fact that the flight alone was minimally probative, given the fact the lack of any other evidence connecting to the defendant in that case to the contraband in the residence.
Mr. Neuer, you have 5 minutes left in your opening, so do you want to pivot to your Second Amendment argument, unless my colleagues have any questions on the first issue? Okay.
I will reserve the remainder of my time for the rebuttal. Thank you.
No, you have 5 minutes left. Do you say you want 10 minutes for your rebuttal because you have
five? Oh,
no,
sorry. Yes. Okay, thank you. Should this court disagree with Mr. McKnight's first argument? Alternatively, Mr. McKnight argues that his conviction should be reversed because the unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon statute is facially unconstitutional, where there is no sufficiently similar historical analog to the automatic, indiscriminate, punitive and indefinite disarmament caused by the unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon statute. Initially, the state in its briefs didn't attempt at all to engage in any historical analysis. Via the supplemental briefs, it has. Just to briefly discuss whether the Second Amendment applies to felons, it should be noted that the defendant in Rahimi, in a two-month span, was involved in multiple shootings in and around Texas, in and around Arlington, Texas. And also involved in the selling of narcotics. He was shooting into an individual's residence, into multiple cars. He left the scene of an accident. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, noting his pre-sentence investigation report, detailed what it quote said was a lengthy criminal history. Seems to be no indication that he was in any way a law-abiding, responsible citizen. Nevertheless, the Rahimi court did go into a substantive Bruin analysis regarding the statute at issue in that case. The central question in these Bruin issues is both how and why the regulation burdens the Second Amendment right to bear arms. And even if a law regulates arm bearing for a permissible reason, it may still be incompatible with the Second Amendment if it does so to an extent beyond what was done at the founding.
Were violent individuals at the birth of our nation and the colonies in the early states, violent individuals restricted from owning guns?
Based on the state's burden to establish that, Your Honor, I'm not sure.
You're not sure. So you don't know what the history. You do cite some articles, and I read them, and I don't agree that they say what you say they say, but. The one from Montana, in fact, the conclusion is that prohibitions of violent felons may be presumptively lawful, that are presumptively lawful under, are not presumptively, may be presumptively lawful under Heller, but that there's a difference between a violent felon and a nonviolent felon. And that article said that if you're nonviolent, it came to a different conclusion than those that are violent under the history. So it seemed to me to be an article that would support what the state's position is.
Well, according to the state's position, from what I was aware of, the surety laws were the most similar historical analogy that the state cited. Surety laws were more usually didn't even actually disarm the individual; they just posted a surety. And the United States Supreme Court in Rahimi, it's important to note that it looked to the why of the burden, and typically, surety laws were used as to prevent spousal abuse. So it was actually a closer analogy in Rahimi, where the statute at issue was to prevent someone under a someone with alleged spousal abuse from holding a firearm. In this case, it's an automatic and indefinite disarmament without a sufficient historical analogy.
Well, but is your argument, Mr. Nouri, that historically, at the founding, the states, the nation barred domestic abusers from possessing firearms, but not other violent folks?
There, according to some of the historical analysis, surety laws were used on prior occasions at the founding. One of the reasons for them were to prevent spousal abuse. Whether dangerous, quote unquote, dangerous people were disarmed, it's the state's burden to establish they were sufficiently similar, disarmed in a similar way, if it was as broad as the unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon statute was, if it was automatic, if it was indefinite, if it was as punitive, if
Do
there
they
was
have to
no.
do that, or can we take judicial notice?
Of course, this court can take judicial notice.
So let's, isn't it true that in the early years of this nation, various groups were restricted from having guns?
Various groups, yes, typically for perhaps prejudicial reasons, various groups were prevented.
Well, wasn't it safety reasons? And at that time, there was the idea was not it was safety more than prejudice. I mean, it was prejudicial, yes, to turn into the groups, but it was for their own safety, was it not?
That was the reason given for some of those disarmament regulations then. Reliance on those examples today, when most courts would find the justification for those weak, then does seem minimally probative to the regulation at issue in this case, though.
But it's an analog. I mean, we're looking for an analogy at the beginning of the nation. And there were groups of people that were prohibited from owning guns. That's the analogy, that it's a different group. That's an issue, but it had to do with safety. It did not.
I believe that was the given justification. Again, I would say the real justification was animus towards politically disfavored groups. Of course, they cloaked that in the name of dangerousness. But again, there's also no explanation of the length, the duration, the comprehensiveness of such disarmament, and whether there was any chance for those disfavored groups to come into possession of firearms.
So do we don't we need to have some kind of historians then testify? Is that what you're saying? Or
Based on the
you want a
record,
full-blown hearing on a history lesson?
well, the Second Amendment provides this right that is guaranteed in the Second Amendment, and if the state wants to have such a broad permanent ban, then yes, it should be held to a high standard to justify it with a historical analogy that's sufficiently similar. I will remain, I
Your
will.
time is up. Let me ask my colleagues if they have any other questions before I turn to Ms. Slattery. Hearing none, thank you, Mr. Nouri. We'll come back to you. Ms. Slattery.
Thank you. May it please the court. Defendant's challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence lacks merit. Here, the people presented sufficient evidence that defendant, an undisputed convicted felon, was in constructive possession of the firearm and guilty of UUW felon beyond a reasonable doubt.
Do you have any cases that say that inference alone is enough? He says there is no cases. He's looked and he finds nothing like this.
There's plenty of cases talking about the fact that constructive possession and knowledge is often proved by circumstantial evidence. We rarely have direct evidence. You have direct evidence when it's actual possession, which is not the case here. So we do have the flight, and I'll get into the flight, but we also have the undisputed fact that defendant was the sole occupant and driver of the vehicle at all relevant times, before the stop, during the stop, during his flight, and when he crashed into two other cars.
Do we know whether it was his car?
We don't. And as the trial court noted, the question is possession and not one of ownership. So the fact that we don't know who the owner of the car is does not preclude a finding that the defendant had constructive possession of the firearm that was in the car.
Well, if he had no knowledge, if it wasn't his car, then you know, people don't usually get into a car and look in the glove compartment. I mean, if that isn't, seems to me it could go either way, that issue. Just because somebody's sitting in the driver's seat of a car, if they don't own it, that would be pretty dangerous that any of us could get into a car, not look in the glove compartment, and later on find there's a gun.
True. I mean, I think the fact that it was in the glove compartment and in reaching distance of the defendant is significant. Also, the fact that unlike People versus Hampton, which the defendant cites, you know, the gun wasn't concealed within a sock within the glove compartment. Based on the relevant testimony, it appears that once the glove compartment was opened, it was in plain view.
Yeah, but you said that alone should be circumstantial evidence that because it was within arm's of reach.
True, true.
But that's why he's saying that there needs to be something else. I mean, that I think that's what the defendant's arguing. I mean, that's not enough.
So we don't just have the, you know, defendant's presence in the vehicle or the fact that it was within view. I mean, those are all relevant factors. We have to talk about the flight. It can't just be discounted. The trial court found that his flight was extremely probative of his consciousness of guilt. And looking at everything that happened, you know, the stop started out pretty benignly. Defendant was initially cooperative, and then defendant stopped being cooperative and took off at a high rate of speed. Defendant's flight, as the trial court noted, was pretty probative of consciousness of guilt and of his knowledge of the weapon in the car, especially given the fact that the inventory search of the vehicle yielded only one thing of note, and that was the firearm that was in the glove compartment. So it's not just flight. It's not just defendant being driving the car. It's not just the fact that the firearm was in reaching distance of the defendant. It's the confluence of all these factors that supports the trial court's finding that the defendant had constructive possession of the firearm and was guilty of UUW felon beyond a reasonable doubt. Although the defendant attempted to, at trial, in his post-trial motion, to provide alternative explanations as to why he might have fled from the police, it's clear that the trial court did consider those factors, and the trial court was not required to accept all potential innocent explanations and make that rise to the level of reasonable doubt. It's the people's position that construing all of the evidence in the light most favorable to the people, that the evidence was sufficient to prove that defendant had control over and knowledge of the firearm to establish his guilt of UUW felon beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, with respect to the defendant's constitutional challenges.
Before you move on, Ms. Slattery. So, you know, the Singram case, Mr. Nouri points out that the gun was in plain view, so it's really irrelevant whether the defendant took off, right?
It's not. It's courts consider all of the relevant factors of the stop. So in Ingram, the defendant was not even driving the car, so he was a passenger. There was a firearm that was in plain view in the back seat of the car. And then in talking about the whether the defendant had knowledge, the court found that it was extremely important or indicative of his knowledge that of the fact that he fled. So the people were deciding that for the proposition.
Oh, so if the gun, let's say, was, in the center console where the defendant had to have seen it, the fact that he took off is really irrelevant because it's right there in front of him. On the other hand, if it's in the back seat, is there some suggestion that maybe he didn't know about it?
There could have,
Go ahead.
yeah, there could have been. And so to, one of the reasons why that the inference could be made that the defendant had knowledge was because he did flee. That's why the court placed such import on the flight, in Ingram.
What about I think Mr. Nouri said it, I think he said the Tate case where the court held that the flight was minimally probative.
I think Tate, so that was drugs in a house. I think the defendant in that case, he wasn't the only one that was in the residence or had access to the residence. So again, there are, differences here. We have the defendant, he's the only one in the car, in control the entire time prior to the stop, during and afterwards. So all of these cases, there might be, they share some similarities, but there are important differences because all of these constructive possession cases are so, fact dependent.
Well, isn't it
Well,
also
remind me, what
that
were some of the innocent explanations that the defendant offered for his flight?
the fact that he was on parole, the fact that he was a person of color, I think were the two that his attorney argued.
Isn't it probative of the fact that he did not flee until there were officers on either side of the car and he was asked to get out? I mean, the timing of his fleeing.
Sure. Yeah, I think the timing of the flight is incredibly important. Although we didn't have specific furtive movements toward the glove compartment, he tried to take the entire car with him. So, yes, that's I think that's a very important factor, and that
Mean,
supports
because
the
before that, there was no indication he was about to flee. He was cooperative until that point.
right.
It isn't as if he was stopped by police and then he pulled out immediately.
Right. Yeah, the circumstances of when he fled, yes, I also agree that's pretty important. So I can address this the constitutional challenges quickly if we're done with the first issue. So the Second Amendment has never been interpreted to provide an unfettered access to firearms to any person at any time. And the UUW felon statute here, which prohibits felons from possessing firearms, accords with Bruin's applicable test. So first, the conduct regulated by the statute, prohibiting
Let
felons
me
from.
ask a question. What's your response to defendant's argument that you have not met your burden?
So I think he was talking about the historical analog. So the people cited to a number of analogs in our brief and in our supplemental brief. There has been throughout history evidence of status-based disarmament laws. Various groups have been disarmed due to their perceived dangerousness, including religious affiliations, ethnicities, and disloyalty. And these status-based disarmament laws were enacted due to the fact that these groups were perceived to be unwilling to follow the law. There's also, surety laws. The courts that have analyzed this issue have analyzed it to surety laws and going arms laws, which essentially were designed to prevent people who pose a danger from using firearms in a way that, menace society. And the surety laws were not limited to domestic violence cases. That should be clear. There's also been a historical tradition of punishing serious offenses, both violent and nonviolent, through the death and the forfeiture of property. which would also include firearms. So although, you know, the specific statutes at issue are a product of the 20th century, they have evolved from pre-existing prohibitions restricting access to firearms. So the people's position that the UUW felon statute does not violate the tenets of the Second Amendment or the Illinois Constitution either.
Anything else, Ms. Slattery?
No, unless there are any further questions, the people respectfully request the support to affirm defendant's UUW felon conviction.
My colleagues have questions? Yes.
Oh, Ms. Slattery, what is your view about the Second Amendment, including people who are felons versus law-abiding citizens? Does the state take a position that if you are a non-law-abiding citizen, the Second Amendment does not?
Yeah, it's the people's position, and the majority of courts that have addressed this in this in the at the appellate court level have found that the people referenced in the Second Amendment refers to law-abiding citizens. The Second Amendment has long been tied to virtuous citizenship, and the United States Supreme Court, throughout its Second Amendment jurisprudence, has repeatedly used the term law-abiding when talking about the scope of the Second Amendment. And the court has also made it a point in Heller and in Bruin and Rahimi to note that, you know, statutes disarming felons and those who are mentally ill from possessing firearms are presumptively lawful. So it's the people's position that with respect to the, you know, the first portion of the Bruin test, that felons are not included in amongst the people that the Second Amendment applies to.
People recognize that there is a split.
Yes, a small minority have found that people encompasses both law-abiding and non-law-abiding people. So in Brooks, a different division of this court held that. In Travis, the Third District also held that. I think it's important to note that those cases did not appear to give pay that much attention to the specific phraseology that the United States Supreme Court employed throughout its Second Amendment cases. The fact that, you know, the phrase law-abiding was used by the courts in Bruin, I guess 18 times in majority opinion and the concurrences. It's pretty important, and neither Brooks nor Travis.
Well, but so in Rahimi, the court also said, yeah, we use the word responsible many, many times, but we didn't really mean it. So.
Well, they didn't say that they didn't mean responsible. They said the responsible is not, it's not something that's clearly defined. I think law-abiding is something that is much more clear. And in Rahimi, you know, the defendant in that case, as opposing counsel noted, he was clearly not a law-abiding individual. So while they would not necessarily disarm him because he was quote unquote not responsible, the fact that he was not law-abiding supported the court's decision.
Anything else from my colleagues? Okay, thank you, Ms. Leonard. And Mr. Murray.
Yes, just a couple quick things regarding argument two before I'd like to focus the rest of my time on the reasonable doubt, because Mr. McKnight does want to maintain that this case should be decided on non-constitutional grounds because he never possessed the firearm. But the fact that in Rahimi the court recognized that he was not law-abiding and yet still engaged in a Second Amendment analysis actually supports Mr. McKnight's argument in this case. If non-law-abiding means the Second Amendment doesn't apply, then there was the that would be the first step of Bruin. The second step wouldn't be necessary. Going to there was a little discussion about Ingram, and there was a question from Your Honor regarding the gun being in the back seat. And I just wanted to clarify that, and this is quoting from the case here. The testifying officer described the gun as in plain view, right behind the driver's seat. A photograph depicted the gun on the red carpet floor with nothing else in the immediate vicinity. Because the front passenger seat was broken, the seat was resting in the back seat right next to where the gun was found. So the passenger was sitting next to the firearm. The size of the gun made it easily identifiable as a gun, and defendant had not just entered the car, but had been in the car for a sufficient period of time, implying knowledge. That's all discussed before there's any mention of the flight being used as inference of knowledge.
So just to be clear, you're saying that the defendant was in the back seat and that the gun was on the floor behind the driver's seat, and so he had to have known about it. Is that your point?
That was a sufficient inference of or indicia of knowledge that the gun was in plain view from where the passenger was sitting in the car. Yes, I just wanted to clarify because it was a little confusing that the passenger was in the front seat, but that based on something going on in this car, he was actually sitting in the back next to the firearm, which was in plain view. And then just to go through some of these cases cited by the state and its response brief regarding flight, there was a Jones case, 2019. Officers responded to a call of someone with a firearm. The defendant fled. The officer gave chase, saw the defendant reaching in his waistband, tossing a black object that made a metallic noise. And People versus Miller, also cited by the state, the defendant was seen with something in his hand, and he was seen reaching behind a staircase, hiding it, and then ran away with his hand empty. Similarly, in People versus Anderson, again, it was flight. The officer saw him tucking, reaching from his waistband before throwing something. I already discussed People versus Al-Juhani, where there the police knocked on the door, and the defendant escaped from the rear of the residence. When earlier in the day there was screaming heard inside the apartment and a body was found in that same residence. In People versus Jackson, the defendant was the owner of an entire building. Narcotics were found in one of the units, and in the basement unit where the defendant was seen fleeing to, officers found baggies and a scale with heroin remnants that matched the contraband that was found in a separate unit. So just to be clear, again, there's no case with this minimal amount of evidence where a court of appeal has upheld a conviction based on constructive possession. As I stated, that constructive possession does, of course, require circumstantial evidence, but it has to have some actual evidence of knowledge in some way that can satisfy the state's burden here. It's not a strict liability offense. And fleeing alone, again, does not create strict liability for anything that's subsequently recovered from a vehicle that a person does not own or regularly use or control. As such, Mr. McKnight requests that this court reverses convictions because the state failed to prove that he possessed the gun found in the glove box of the glove compartment of the car that he was driving. Alternatively, Mr. McKnight argues that this court should reverse his conviction because the unlawful use of a weapon unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon statute is facially unconstitutional. Thank you.
Any more questions from my colleagues? Okay, hearing none. Mr. Nouri and Ms. Slattery, thank you for your informed argument. The case is submitted and we will issue a decision in due course. Have a good day.